Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. Just a week ago, President Bush signed a new major tax cut package in the amount of, at least on the face of it, the amount is $1.35 trillion. This was something that he had certainly talked about a great deal in the campaign, and although perhaps the president didn't get the size of the tax cut that he wanted, it did allow him to keep a major campaign promise, and certainly so far it's been his biggest legislative victory. However, there is a great deal about this tax cut that is uncertain, as we will discuss here in this part of Focus 580, because one of the provisions of the law is that in the not-too-distant future, if it's not renewed, things go back to the way that they were before. Also, already in Washington, some members of Congress are talking about making changes. But what we'll try to do this morning, at least, is to talk about the package as it is and what it means for various kinds of people in this country. And our guest for the program is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois. He's particularly interested in elder law and has discussed with us before on this program Social Security and what's happening with that. And we've talked about that more than once. And no doubt in the future, we will talk about it again. But this morning, we're going to concentrate on this tax cut package. And as we talk, of course, questions are certainly welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. And if it would be a long-distance call, we have a toll-free line you can use, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being with us once again.
Thank you, David.
Just again, to make the point at the beginning, if people have been following the coverage of this, they will be aware of this. But if not, to make the point again, sort of two things. One is that the provisions of this law take effect gradually over a period of time. So it will take a number of years before this completely, everything in this goes into effect. And on the last day of December of the year 2010, if this is not renewed by the Congress, everything goes back to the way it was before. The old tax rates, the estate tax, one day it'll be gone and the next day it'll be back, unless, of course, they make that change. So there seems to be some uncertainty about whether, in fact, all of the provisions of this will actually go into effect. And then if they do, will they stay?
You're quite correct. There's no doubt that the past two decades have seen a lot of tax law instability. What this package does is guarantee that that instability will continue. And in fact, in many cases, there are provisions of the law that will not even occur while President Bush is president. That is, many of these do not occur until the year 2009, 2010, so that even if he is reelected, he will not be president then. We will have two presidential elections before many of these provisions take effect, and we will have no fewer than five congressional elections. It is extremely unlikely that during that period, when personnel is changing in the House and Senate, that everyone who is elected to office will feel that tax law is off the table, that all the decisions have been made, that they cannot change, tinker, or reprioritize. And this law basically guarantees that certain provisions of the tax law will be on the agenda because they are going to expire unless they are renewed.
Mm-hmm. It seems, on the one hand, it seems unlikely that the Congress would simply let things snap back to the way that they were. But having said that, then one doesn't really know what they will do in the meantime.
You're exactly right. In fact, if they did nothing, in the year 2011, we would have the single largest tax increase in our history. Not just the estate tax that you mentioned, but all the tax rates would go in one dramatic year back up. Here they had been phased down over a fairly long trajectory, and here within literally one day, they would snap back to the year 2000. Not even the year 2001, but the year 2000 rates. Other provisions, such as a deduction for college tuition, actually expire along the way. So you have more than just the year 2010 sunset to worry about. There are provisions that will expire halfway through this period, and then there are other provisions, particularly relating to marriage tax penalty relief, that do not begin until 2006. So there are several elements of instability. One is the sunset provision 2010, where the whole package disappears. The other is the variety of provisions that do not take effect until 3, 4, 5, or even 8 years in the future. And it's very easy to simply defer those initial starting dates and postpone the revenue loss.
Well, I want to talk in some detail about some of the provisions. And let's start by talking about tax rates. What this bill does is it creates a new tax bracket on the bottom for the people with the least money. And then for everybody else, it lowers the brackets. So the top rate, which is now 39.6%, will go down to 35, and so on and so forth. So each one is going to come down a couple of points.
Yeah, the math is mind-boggling. The 39.6% rate affects less than 1% of the population, but you're quite right. It's going down to 35%, but that's not for another 9 years. Interestingly enough, President Bush had campaigned on the idea that he wanted to make the current 5-rate structure simpler by going to 4 rates. By the introduction of this 10% rate for low-income people that you mentioned, it's actually going from 5 rates to 6. That is not as significant, however, as the fact that the rate that applies to 71% of Americans, namely the 15% tax rate, is not being lowered. So that one of the fallacies of this rate is that all tax rates are declining. Actually, the rate that applies to most Americans, the 15% rate, is not scheduled for any reduction throughout this period. It's only the rates above 15% that are being gradually reduced.
So there was a lot of when this was all in the works, there was a lot of discussion about who benefits whether indeed it benefits people on the upper income levels more than people on the bottom. Setting that question aside for a moment, is it the case or is it not the case that everyone will see some reduction in their taxes?
Everyone will see some reduction in their taxes eventually. Mm. Even that 10% rate, for example, doesn't apply to children or other dependents for this year. They'll begin to see some relief next year. But the biggest impact of these rate reductions is going to be at the upper end, both because there's more income involved and because the rate reductions are greater. For calendar year 2001, the rates that are going down are basically by 0.5%. That's almost imperceptible. And I think that's actually the rationale for these famous refund checks that are going to come out in September or earlier of $300 per single individual, $600 for married folks. I think the Congress correctly perceived that the tax rate reduction for most people was going to be so small that they wouldn't actually see it. Even if the withholding tables were adjusted immediately. And so that's why they wanted this little lump sum, some would say it's a gimmick, for them to see the rate reduction. In fact, that whole check mechanism is actually not a refund of prior year's taxes. It's an advance lowering of this coming year's taxes. So the point was that you would have gotten this benefit in April of 2002 anyway, but the fear was that most Americans who either use computer software preparation programs or outside preparation services would not realize that their taxes had really gone down, and so that's why a separate check was being sent so as to make it obvious. Mm-hmm. But the point is that everyone is getting the benefit other than dependents and certain other ineligible individuals. Everyone's getting the benefit of that reduction on the first $6,000 and $12,000.
Mm-hmm. What we should expect is that this is a one-time special offer. This is not likely to happen again.
Probably not. On the other hand, starting in the year 2002, everyone will get the benefit of that rate reduction because that 10% bracket will then be put into the rate structure.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the tax cut package that was just signed into law by President Bush just about a week ago, and what exactly is in it. Your questions are welcome, and we have somebody here ready to go, and we get some others, and we'll work in as many people as we can. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Let's go talk with a caller here in Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Yes. There's a real basic point about this discussion that I don't think I understand, and maybe I'm the only person in the world that doesn't. You say that there's going to be a $1.3 trillion deduction of our taxes.
Right.
Is that true? Now, is that the amount of taxes that's going to be reduced from what we pay now or from what we will be paying then in the end of the 10 years?
Yeah, the revenue loss numbers are very, very, shall we say, fanciful. It's based on the idea that if the Congress did nothing, they would collect $1.35 trillion more than if this law went into effect. That $1.35 trillion itself is so wishy-washy compared to all the attention that was paid to it, because it's not a lump sum. It comes in a certain amounts over the next 10 years, and it's based upon a whole variety of assumptions of economic growth, employment, immigration, price of energy, all kinds of things which are not really very knowable even 6 months in advance. And the magnitude of error between what's really going on and what's assumed gets larger the further you go out. But this is the way the game is played. And these are the revenue rules that supposedly discipline Congress to, otherwise they would just give away the complete store. But they have to at least come up with some estimate of how much revenue they will not be collecting because of these reductions compared to if they had done nothing.
So then, if I understand from your discussion and the understanding, then if at the end of 10 years we're $1.3 trillion less, so if you average that per year, you divide it, you get about $150 billion, right?
That's correct, but it doesn't come.
You divide that by the number of people. Nobody really gets very much, do they?
Well, that's true. Actually, it's less than your analysis would suggest, because it doesn't come in even 10-year, even annual increments. Because the revenue comes on stream later in the period, so that the first couple years we're talking about $30 billion, maybe $60 billion. I'm reminded of the comment that former Illinois Senator Everett Dirksen once said about $1 billion here, $1 billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. And $1 billion is certainly a great deal, but in this context, that's sort of the currency of the realm. But it is very much backloaded. The estate tax provision in particular loses very little revenue for the first 6 or 7 years. And then there is a gigantic revenue decrease in that final year. So if you were to graph the $1.35 trillion, the first 3 to 4 years is relatively small, $25 to $50 billion. And when you divide it by the number of people, you're quite correct. The amount is not a great deal. Further, it's not allocated according to the number of people. It's allocated according to tax burden. And since the top half of American taxpayers actually pay something like 96% of all income taxes, they are going to get most of the reduction. And so a much smaller group of Americans will benefit. Something like 35% of Americans don't pay any income tax whatsoever. So they are automatically excluded. That's not to say they don't pay any taxes. Many times they pay a great deal in Social Security taxes and payroll taxes for Medicare. In fact, nearly three-quarters of all Americans actually pay more in Social Security taxes than they do in income taxes. This tax package, however, says absolutely nothing about those payroll taxes. Its focus is exclusively on income taxes, and so therefore the people who pay the bulk of the income taxes would be receiving the bulk of the tax reductions.
Thank you for the enlightenment.
All right, thank you. Just again, to go back to the point that had been made by many people beforehand, that these changes primarily benefit wealthier Americans. If you if you set aside for a moment the elimination of the estate tax, which is for some people is going to be quite significant, and you look simply at income tax, does this really benefit disproportionately? Does it benefit higher income individuals?
I don't see how anyone can contend otherwise. The fact of the matter is that the upper half of Americans who pay income taxes at all, and remember here we've already cut out about a third who owe no income taxes simply because their income isn't high enough. The upper half provides 96% of all revenue, and it's of all income tax revenue, and it's even more skewed when you then get up to further percentages, so that, for example, the top 10% pay nearly 55% of all income taxes. Now, we could balance that by pointing out that they actually have approximately that amount of the total national income, so that their tax burden is proportional to their income, but income in this country is very disproportionately concentrated at the upper end, and therefore the taxes are, and accordingly the tax reductions will be. The people at the from about the midpoint on down pay the bulk of the Social Security taxes, and if we were to provide Social Security tax relief, they would get the bulk of that relief. But this bill was specifically designed to focus on income taxes and not to provide any reduction of Social Security tax relief. The inevitable result of that is that if we're going to focus on the one tax that is paid disproportionately by upper-income individuals, namely the income tax, then any tax reduction that applies to that revenue stream will benefit those people disproportionately.
All right, let's continue. We have somebody on a car phone, so I want to go to them. Line one, hello.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
My question is, if half of this tax cut would go down against the national debt, will it not add, say, $400 or $500 billion to the national treasury? And therefore, we shouldn't call it a 1.35. We should call it like 1.85 or whatever number is.
You're absolutely right. In fact, part of the whole revenue estimation of this tax cut has several elements of fantasy. I mentioned the various assumptions already. Your question points out another level of fantasy, namely that what they look at is simply the revenue that would not be collected. Another approach would have been to calculate what if you had used the revenue to pay down the debt. Not only would you have that additional revenue, but you would have paid off the debt and saved the future interest cost. Now, most of that interest savings would be after the 10-year period, but it would definitely redound to the benefit of American taxpayers in the future. That was, in fact, a major debate by a number of people who opposed this large a tax cut. Their contention was that the entire amount shouldn't be devoted to tax reduction, but at least some significant portion should be devoted to debt reduction. It's kind of amazing that when we're dealing with numbers that could easily be splits, that is, allocate one sum for tax relief and another sum, perhaps smaller, for debt payment, that none of it was basically allocated for debt repayment, which would have had the benefit down the road of not only reducing the interest costs of the government, but also reducing interest costs of all other American borrowers, whether they are home buyers, car buyers, et cetera, because that amount of credit would not be soaked up by the federal government. A great many people, and in fact the policy of the prior administration, was to do just that, namely to keep the tax system as it was and simply apply any surplus to paying down the debt. That was an issue that was discussed, and the people who wanted to pay down the debt basically lost in the effort.
Another question: are there any checks and balances in this new tax code that will provide Congress or the president to reverse this trend if some of the assumptions are not materializing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. There was a movement by some in the Senate the so-called monitoring, to put in automatic triggers. That is, that if certain budget forecasts were not met, that future rate reductions would not go into effect without anyone having to vote on it. That did not get passed. The view of the administration was they didn't want that kind of instability. So an automatic check was proposed but rejected. On the other hand, Congress meets, and this is simply legislation. It is not a constitution, and therefore it requires only 51% of the votes in each House and a willing president to reverse, forestall, defer, or repeal any part of it. The package is made up of 441 separate changes to the Internal Revenue Code, so they don't have to repeal the entire act. They can actually go through, prioritize, pick and choose, select which provisions they want to defer still further, which ones they want to simply eliminate, and they can do this for any reason. They can do it because the economic forecasts are proving inaccurate. They can do it because the economy is overheating. They can do it because they want to add a prescription drug benefit or expand military spending. They can do it for any reason. So as long as Congress is meeting, they can always change any of these provisions. None of them are cast in stone, but they will have to do something affirmative. That is, the effort for there to be an automatic trigger was proposed and defeated.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just, I'm afraid people are going to get real snowed down in the numbers here, but I guess one final point to make on this question of, if you think about it this way, what's the price tag on this tax package? That you ask different people, you're going to get different answers. But it seems to me the long and the short of it is, if you ask that question, is the price tag of this actually $1.3 trillion? There are a lot of people who would say to you, well, actually, no, it's more than that. If you ask how much less money will the government have as a result of this law, it is probably more than $1.35 trillion.
There's a lot of evidence to that effect. There is a countervailing theory that actually the cost is less because this will so stimulate the economy and get people working more that they will have more incentive to save, invest, work longer hours, and so forth, that they will be paying more taxes on their increased income. That, of course, was the supply-side notion of the Reagan Revolution, and to some extent it was validated, and to some extent it wasn't. The American economy is a very dynamic beast, and it's very hard to estimate very far in advance what will happen when you make a single tax change. When you have a whole slew of nearly 400 tax changes, then the interaction of these variables and general economic conditions is impossible to predict. For example, there is a whole notion in economic theory that says if tax rates are going down, people will work less because they will have the same after-tax income with less effort, which would make the tax revenue even smaller than is projected, or to put it in the way that you did, namely the tax cost of this legislation would be much higher than 1.35, without even getting into the possibility of what you could have done with that money, paying off the debt and saving the interest, which would have jacked it up still further.
We're already at the midpoint here. We've got some other callers. We'll keep talking with folks. And I'd just like to introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus. We're speaking with Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at the University of Illinois Law School, and has been with us before to talk about other sorts of things. We've talked a couple of times with him about Social Security. And here now this morning we're talking about this federal tax cut package that was just signed by the president last week. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. The next caller is in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was a little confused about the this tax refund, pre-year tax refund, and I was wondering how much one had to have actually earned the past year to qualify for that.
It's a super question, because this is one of those typical paradoxes of tax law. It seems very simple, and most people will get $300 per person, so a married couple would get $600. But it becomes much more complicated because it's calculated on the basis of people's 2000 income, that is, the income that they showed on their 2000 return. So if they showed less than $6,000, they're not going to get the whole $300. It's basically 5% of their tax in the year 2000 on the first $6,000 of income, married folk, it would be the first $12,000. If their income in the year 2000, however, was less than that amount, they will get some smaller number. And what makes it even more confusing is if, since this is not a refund of the year 2000 taxes, but an advance on the year 2001, if their income fluctuates to the point where their income is significantly higher or lower in the year 2001, they'll actually have to reconcile the check with their tax liability in a special worksheet that has yet to be derived, but will be part of our welcoming package that we get after the first of the year. But it's basically the first $6,000 of income for a single person, $12,000 for a married couple, with the further proviso that if we're talking about people who are claimed as dependents, they are ineligible for this taxable year entirely.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go next to another Urbana person, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, I'm from Aurora.
Oh, my apologies. Well,
That's okay. Well,
go ahead.
I'm apologizing, too. I have three things to say. In your estimation, would there have been a better way to give a tax cut? The way I see it, there's so much paperwork that has to be done. It would seem to me if you just lowered the tax rate instead of doing all this paperwork that's going to cost so much money and have so many problems, that was my thought on it. And do you think this is a good way of doing it? And the other thing that came to my mind was, do you think this is really an honest-to-goodness tax break, or is there an ulterior motive behind it? And I'll hang up and let you talk.
All right.
Thank you for the question. The first part, in terms of the better way, this is obviously a very subjective question. In terms of the paperwork, you're absolutely right. This is a complicated way of doing so. For what it's worth, President Bush proposed a very simple approach of simply reducing the tax rates. He did not have this special 10% bracket in there. He did not have this advance refund check. That was not part of the Bush proposal. The Bush proposal was simply to lower the current five rates, to collapse them into four, and to lower them over a period of time. It was a fairly simple and straightforward approach. The president proposes, Congress disposes, is the old line. This is a democracy. The president can come up with whatever ideas he or she wants, but the Constitution allocates primary responsibility for tax legislation to the Congress. And therefore, they, even if they are in agreement, they may have some different ideas. The House of Representatives, under a very strict party control, passed a bill that was a little more complicated than what President Bush had proposed, but was still relatively clean. It did include the special 10% rate in response to the concern that if you just went with a rate reduction across the board, that the benefits were going to be so disproportionately allocated to the upper income people. And so they felt they needed to provide something tangible to the lower end. As is always the case with tax legislation, there are conflicting objectives. President Bush's proposal basically didn't care how the chips fell, wanted to simply provide a tax rate reduction. The people in the House of Representatives, however, wanted to provide a little more tax relief for people at the bottom of the scale in response to criticism. Still further, then they realized that these rate reductions wouldn't take effect till next year and would not show up on people's tax return until they did it until in April of 2003, which was after the next congressional election. So that entered a political imperative. Tax law is never just about economics and certainly not about paperwork reduction. And so the political imperative is we need to, the Congress thought, we need to provide a tax cut that people can see and see before they go to the polls in 2002. So that's what spawned this whole idea of a refund check, which is the first time this has ever been done, probably won't be done again. It's costing actually some $87 million for the IRS to process all of these checks, which they would otherwise not be sending. So this is an additional cost that it was incurred simply for the political reason of making sure people get it. In terms of the broader approach, your question raises a fantastic issue about what does this say about tax simplification? And if anybody had any hopes for tax simplification, and some of us still dream of that, this is a tremendous slap in the face. As I say, 441 new tax code changes are put in. And what makes this particularly ironic is that the Congressional Committee on Taxation came up with a comprehensive study on what makes the tax code complex just this past April and provided 230 specific recommendations of making things simpler. The current tax package adopted three out of those 230 recommendations, and even then they did so for the purpose of reducing rates on particular constituencies, not for the purpose of simplifying things. When push came to shove, they opted for tax reduction rather than simplification. So simplification is dead, the flat rate idea is dead, because what this showed is that when you have a fairly conservative anti-government proposal on the table, when it really gets through Congress, it gets much more complicated. The Senate, of course, which I have mentioned and not mentioned up till now, is a very independent body, and they had their own set of priorities. They were not as keen on the whole idea of across-the-board tax cuts, and because of the closely divided part of the Senate between Republicans and Democrats, each senator was an important vote. Many of the senators thought it was much more important to stimulate retirement savings and thought that those kind of targeted tax benefits to encourage people to put more into IRAs and 401ks and that sort of thing was a higher priority than rate reduction. Another group of senators thought that the middle class, particularly those saving for their kids' college education, were the ones who needed relief more than just these tax rate reductions, and therefore they wanted to see targeted relief for various means of saving for college education costs. As a result, you had these conflicting pressures, and in order to get the votes of the people who had higher or different priorities, it was necessary to throw in these additional provisions relating to education, relating to retirement, relating to child credits, relating to marriage tax penalty relief, in order to get enough people to vote for the bill. Unfortunately, it has been the pattern, not just with this Congress, but literally for the past 40, 50 years, that when Congress is faced with a choice of A or B, it typically picks A plus B and half of C so that they can accommodate as many interests as possible. The result is that you get a bill that you get enough votes for, but it does mean that the goal of tax simplification just completely is lost in the shuffle.
Just and real quick to, and I have other calls, I promise I'll get to them, but to also to say something about the other point that the caller raised, I think that is correct that part of the reason that some conservatives, particularly those who think that they want to limit the size of government, those folks are celebrating this as a victory, is not because it puts money in people's pockets or that it may stimulate the economy, which it may or may not do. They're happy because essentially it means that there's no money for any new spending.
This is the so-called attic approach. That is that Congress is addicted to spending and that if the money is on the table, they will spend it. There is a fair amount of empirical evidence that this is a valid concern, whether the Congress is dominated by Republicans or Democrats. They may have different spending priorities, but the point is that they all have particular projects that they think ought to be funded, and in many cases they think are a higher priority for the nation as a whole than simply tax relief. And so the concern was if the money is there, it will be spent either on programs that they disapprove of or just that this will provide more government services. And so for those who want to, you might say, wean the American populace from government, they wanted to starve the national government from additional funds to do any sort of objective. The concern of these people said, and there's some The proof from prior years is that if you try to aim for a surplus that will be used to pay down the debt, the fact of the matter is that Congress is some kind of uncontrolled sugar addict, will have to go in and spend it because they won't be able to keep their hands off of it.
Yeah, and so that this final point, we get to the goals. This goes back to the, perhaps in a way, goes back to this question about, do we think, what's the likelihood that Congress may come along and change this? If now, as a result of this, because you've taken all this money off the table, if someone comes along and they decide they want to fund a new program, whether that be, oh, for example, missile defense or, say, prescription drugs for seniors, there's no money for that. So, and if they decide they want to do that, they're going to have to figure out, they're going to have to find the money someplace.
There will be sort of two threads here. One, they will have to find the money by deferring or eliminating some of these tax provisions, or they will have to simply say, we'd like to do this particular benefit, not this year because the money has been taken. We'll take this up in a few years. So, that was an inevitable consequence and a foreseeable one. That was why it was opposed by so-called liberals, I suppose, who were in favor of a prescription drug benefit, but Senator McCain, who was very concerned about rejuvenating the military establishment and was concerned that this was not going to leave enough funds available for that sort of expansion. And so he opposed the tax bill for that reason.
Yeah. All right. Back to the phones here. Next is Champaign, line one. Hello.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Back to how they figure all this stuff and make the projections, and referring back to another guest you had on a number of times, Mark Weisbrot, you know, has pointed out that the projections they use for Social Security are unrealistically bleak, basically projecting, you know, depression economy for the next 30 years or so. And, you know, I just wonder, you know, and it seems to me that they're probably not using the same calculations to figure Social Security that they're using to project this surplus.
You're quite correct. The two sets of projections are done by entirely separate parts of the government, and they look at some of the same variables, but they try to aim different degrees of conservatism. For example, Social Security makes no bones about the idea that they really have no idea what the rate of immigration, of workforce participation by women, by the number of births, and so forth, when you go out more than 2 or 3 years. And so they actually come up with no fewer than 3 sets of projection, an optimistic, a pessimistic, and one that simply is the arithmetic mean. When it comes to these income tax projections, they look at a whole larger set of variables, and they try to come up with a so-called best estimate, not necessarily pro or con, but there is no effort to reconcile the two, so that in any given year, Social Security may be showing one set of economic conditions, typically a fairly bleak one, and yet on the income tax side, the notion is that these tax rates will produce heaven on earth, and therefore the economy will be booming. And a rational person could quite accurately say, do you characters ever talk to each other? And the short answer is no, and they never share data, and they're not even trying to come up with similar benefits. So you're right, it's a curious anomaly that across the street from the Capitol, the Social Security Administration is wailing and gnashing their teeth about how bleak things look, while when it comes to spending revenue that hasn't been even obtained yet, we think things are looking pretty darn rosy.
Kind of reminds me of the movie Dave, where Kevin Kline is impersonating the president, brings in his friend who's an accountant looking over the budget, and you know, the accountant just can't believe that you could run, you know, anything this way.
I remember the movie, and Charles Grodin, playing the accountant, said something about if he ran his business this way, he would be outlawed. That's right, but who makes the rules? The government does. That movie was unfortunately described as fiction.
It seems to me, and I'm not a big fan of this tax cut, but it seems to me it'd be a lot fairer to, you know, certainly people who have the least ability to survive in this economy, if instead, they had, you know, maybe lessened the burden on the Social Security and payroll taxes and offset that by making people continue to pay above the current cutoffs, just raising that some. I mean, you know, this is really skewed, you know, any way you look at it, towards the people who, well, in my estimation anyway, least need it.
There's a lot of sentiment corresponding to what you say, and that was briefly discussed at the beginning of the debate. That is, should some of this go to offset Social Security or to lower that burden? And you may remember some of the earlier speeches this winter and spring from President Bush about we're providing a tax cut to everyone who pays income taxes. And that was crafted pretty precisely. They basically said they were going to ignore Social Security, despite the fact it's no secret that 74% of American taxpayers pay more in Social Security and Medicare's payroll taxes than they pay in income taxes, and a fair number of them pay absolutely nothing. In fact, there was a concern that maybe some of this ought to be done on a per-person basis as a rebate that was proposed for a brief period of time. The White House indicated that it was adamantly opposed. And then another alternative was to make some of this refund be some of these credits be refundable so that people who have zeroed out their income tax liability but still owe some Social Security tax would actually be able to get some of that back. That was resisted mightily by the House of Representatives, but the Senate did insist on it, and so they put it in a very limited way for a very limited amount and only for a few years, then it disappears. But the reason the taxes are always on the agenda is because there are very different points of view throughout our population.
We just have about 6-7 minutes left. Our guest this morning is Richard Kaplan. He's professor of law at University of Illinois. We're talking about the recent tax cut package signed into law just a week ago by the president. We'll try to get in some other folks here in the time that remains and go next to a caller in Urbana on our line two. Hello.
Hi. During the discussion of the tax cut plan, I had read that in conjunction with this effort to get rid of the estate tax on big estates, that what they were going to do was harm the little folks and by the following, and I'm wondering whether this is ended up in the final tax package. If you have stocks, for instance, and when you die and if you're passing them on in your estate, the value of them is figured based on the date of your death. My understanding is that they're going to change that, so the value of the or the basis of the stocks would be figured, or the mutual funds would be figured on when you purchase them. To me, that seems like you're taxing the little guy, because a whole lot of people own mutual funds and stocks now, who would never have enough money to have their estate taxed even under current rules. And can you imagine the record keeping problems? I just can't imagine having to deal with it. Do you know what happened with that finally?
Yes, I do, and it's much worse than you imagine. it's a super point, a fairly technical one, but the so-called step-up in basis rule that you're talking about enables people who receive inherited property to take as their cost the value at the death of the person from whom they received it. The only reason that rule exists is because theoretically that property has already been subject to estate tax. The fact of the matter is that for 98% of people who die, there is no estate tax liability under current law because they don't have enough to reach beyond the exemptions. Nevertheless, all of their heirs receive the benefit of that step-up in basis rule. The difficulty comes is if you eliminate the estate tax for everyone, then don't you feel compelled to eliminate the step-up in basis rule for everyone as well, which would have the effect exactly as you described of hurting the 98% of decedents who never were subject to the estate tax, but instead are now losing the benefit of their step-up. The first point I would make is you don't have to worry about this for at least 9 years, because until the estate tax is completely repealed, the step-up in basis rule is continued without adjustment. Even when the estate tax is repealed, which is only for 1 year, only during the year 2010, so that everyone needs to focus on then that year if nothing changes. Even then, they repeal the step-up in basis rule, but only for amounts that would have been subject to the estate tax. So what happens is, to protect people that you're describing, the 98% who wouldn't have paid estate tax anyway, they will retain the step-up in basis and only for amounts over and above the exemption, which will be about $1.3 million at that point or so, will the carryover basis have to apply. What gets even worse is that for people who do have estates of more than that exemption amount, the heirs will have to find out whether their specific property was part of the carryover or the step-up rule, and they have no way of knowing that without knowing how much the total estate was. And to make it even more unbelievable, the executor will actually be able to determine who among the various heirs are getting a step-up and which ones have carryover basis. So the existing record-keeping that you're talking about now will be cranked up manifold.
I guess it would also apply to your home, because, you know, many people have had their homes, if they own them, go up in value.
That's true. Of course, homes can be sold right now for a tax exemption of $500,000 for married folks, but this would apply to all property, real estate, residences, stocks, mutual funds, etc.
Mm-hmm. I guess the other thing that bothers me about this whole tax cut deal is that there's no sense of community, of what we can accomplish together as a nation. And, for instance, helping our elderly. We don't pay people who take care of our elderly enough money that they can have a living wage. And so there's constant turnover. There's not an adequate training. Nursing homes have a hard time finding people. If you want to stay in your home, it's hard to find somebody who's adequate to care for you. And the government, federal government, is not adequately reimbursing people under Medicare so that they set the base wage, which is really, really low. And to me, that is something I would forego any tax cut for, to make things better, because we're all getting older and our parents are getting older. And that's just one of the things that we could have done as a community, as a whole nation, which you can't do by yourself.
That's probably a subject for at least another separate program, but you're
Yep.
quite right that it's a fundamental conflict. Namely, is it going to be a sense of community, or is it everyone for himself? And you have a very different approach in Europe, where tax rates are clearly higher, but they provide health care, they provide education on the sense that this is the community's responsibility. A countervailing theme in America, and even more so under the current administration, is everyone for himself. Let those who can do so take care of themselves. They don't want this kind of communal responsibility. You see the same thing with Social Security privatization. Do you want a kind of general floor, or do you want everyone to be his or her own retirement plan manager, with the idea that some will come out ahead and many will fall behind? And basically, do we care about those? It's a perennial issue. It came up during the Clinton care debates about 1993-94. I remember a famous comment by one of the European economists to one of the people in the Treasury. Says, how can the wealthiest country in the world with the fastest growth rate not afford basic, or not provide basic health care for its citizens? And the response was, did it ever occur to you that that may be why we have the highest growth rate, or the wealthiest country in the world? So there's a strong anti-communitarian impulse in American politics. It probably receded, as far as I can tell, in the 1930s, but it's not clear that Medicare would be enacted today, let alone Social Security. Right now there's much more of a rugged individualism, which has always distinguished American public policy to some extent, but you're quite right that this tax bill exemplifies it.
We will have to stop there because we're at the end of the time. I'm sorry we have some people we can't take, but I expect we'll be getting back to some of these things on future programs. For the moment, though, we want to say to our guests, to Richard Kaplan, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Richard Kaplan, professor of law here at University of Illinois.